On the show today, Rich and I discuss the final days of Anthony Bourdain and the Queen's favorite cocktail, a Dubonnet and gin. I'm your host, Brad Jackson, and you're listening to the October 3rd, 2022 edition of Coffee and Koshan. Rich, you and I are both big fans of Tony Bourdain, who died tragically by suicide a few years ago now. There has been a lot talked about his death. Several books came out recently. There was the wonderful movie Roadrunner. That was the first movie I saw after the pandemic. There are a lot of people who have talked, but not everyone has talked. Let me put it that way. And most of everything we've heard has been very controlled from the estate as to what has been said about his life and death. There's a new book coming out. You had a great piece about it in The Spectator this week that sort of gives a clearer look at particularly his final days and what came about there, correct?
That's correct. It's a very interesting, obviously I haven't read the book because it hasn't come out yet, but the New York Times had a lengthy story about it. And to your point about things being controlled, the interesting part about this book, and something I didn't get into in my article, is that it seems that Charles Learson, who wrote the book, had access to the estate, because he got a hold of text messages, emails, and things like that. And more importantly, Octavia Butscha Bourdain, who is Tony's ex-wife and who controls his estate, has not spoken publicly about this forthcoming book, either to confirm or deny it. But her silence, in my opinion, speaks volumes about the work that Learson was able to do on this forthcoming book.
Yeah, and what's interesting is you mentioned that these text messages, and like everyone today anyway, Tony was a man who had a smartphone and communicated a lot via texts, and he had an Instagram account and Twitter and that sort of thing. And this book that's coming out later this month really delves into what he said to key people over text, right?
That's correct. And a lot of it deals with his final girlfriend, Asia Argento. And the picture it paints is not pretty, to say the least. Now, this isn't the first time that she's been accused of playing a role in his suicide. And again, the man chose to kill himself. I don't want to get us into libel territory here, but it definitely seems as though Argento was a significant factor in just his mental state and decline over the last few years of his life.
Yeah, and she was a famous person in her own right. She was an actress. She was the daughter of a famous Italian director. She was a director herself. While they were dating, she came out and said that Harvey Weinstein had sexually abused her at a film festival when she was a girl. And she became a big spokesman of the Me Too movement. And Tony also threw his weight behind that in what I thought was kind of an odd way at the time. But, you know, it makes sense. You do those sort of things for people you love. But the thing that really struck me in these text messages that are in your piece is that let me put it this way. Tony was someone who never did anything half-ass, right? If he was going to be a cook, he was going to be the best cook he could be. And by his own admission, he was not a Michelin star chef. However, he was a great cook, and he knew a lot of great cooks, and he knew a lot about great food. When he decided to do a TV show, he didn't do it half-assed. He did a TV show that completely, entirely redefined food and travel television. Every show now tries to be his show, quite unsuccessfully. But when he did something, he did it full force. And you really saw that in his final relationship with Argento, where he changed a lot of things in his life because, as he told his ex-wife in one of these texts in your stories, he was hopelessly in love with her. And so he tried to interweave her into his traveling show and had her show up on camera. She directed. He even fired someone who had won him multiple Emmys and had been on the show for ever and a day because she didn't like him and wanted to do more work. I don't obviously know what she went through as a child, which didn't seem to be a normal childhood by any stretch.
No, not at all.
But it seems, I mean, reading what is available from this book, what you had in your piece, it seems like she really did a number on him, particularly in those final days. She was caught having an affair at what ended up being their favorite hotel. She really threw him for a loop, right?
Right. And she was extremely controlling. When reading about Bourdain, you know, he's lived a hard life. You know, he was a junkie at one point. And towards the end, prior to his relationship with Argento, he had gotten up, what was it, really into, I think, jujitsu?
Yeah, Brazilian jujitsu.
Yeah, and he had stopped smoking, and he was just really focused on his health and himself and his work. And once she came into the picture, he stopped exercising. He started smoking again. You know, he has a unique relationship with his ex-wife in that she remained his confidant to the end. And he had, because of Argento, he had to tell his ex-wife not to post pictures of him with her or his daughter on social media because it upset Argento. She didn't want to acknowledge that he had existed prior to his relationship with her. And to your point about not doing anything half-assed, he just really threw himself into this woman and telling his ex-wife that, you know, I'm just truly and hopelessly in love with this woman. And, you know, something I got into in the piece, I won't completely, you know, go over it all again, but I actually knew Argento through her father. In the broad sense, I don't know them, but I own a number of his movies on DVD, and it was a very interesting thing because he always had female protagonists who just traumatized other women. So normally in the horror genre, you have a man who's going to go to camp and kill all the campers or whatever. But Dario Argento kind of flipped that around, although he normally kept the victims as women also. And he would read the scripts for these movies to Asia when she was like a 9-year-old girl. And it certainly, you know, my takeaway and what I got into the piece is it almost seems like she tried to get revenge on her father through her relationship with Bourdain, where she just, you know, she traumatized him. And that's not conjecture on my part. You look at the text messages, he's, you know, you've been careless with my heart and my life. And just, it was just ugly, ugly business.
Yeah, it really was. And what really hit me, what really hit me the hardest was reading the part in this piece where you highlight the text message exchange he had with Argento right before he committed suicide. He essentially threw out one last plea to her, and she stomped on him. And he simply replied, "Okay," and then went and hung himself. Like, that is... that, like... to read that, and I'll tell you, I've had a very busy week at work, but I read this the other day while having a sandwich, and when you get to that point in the piece, it just hits you like a ton of bricks. Like, I remember I put down my sandwich, and I was like, whoa, And everybody, I sit in this big bullpen room, and everybody around me was like, what? What's going on? What are you doing? And I shared this story with everyone because, like, it's just, it just hits you like a ton of bricks how she just destroyed him at the end.
And since this, you know, whole relationship has resurfaced in light of this book, what was it? She had an Instagram story, which I did not see. And she kind of responded, and it was just very, it was just her with a picture. And let me try to find this real quickly so that I can speak on it. It was just a story, and she had the, she put a picture of herself with a t-shirt on that had "Stop Busting My Balls" superimposed on it, which was the last thing that she said to him.
Wow.
And it's almost like she's trying to portray herself as a victim again in with this resurfacing. And again, you know, we weren't there. We're seeing definitely things that haven't come to light before. And their relationship was definitely volatile. It doesn't sound like it was necessarily monogamous, but she was just very flagrant in the way she behaved. And, in reading about her, I guess that's just kind of the norm. Like, there's an article I found, which I didn't include, where she discusses how when she's making movies, she's like, yeah, I sleep with the people on set. You know, we're just there. What are you going to do? And then she kind of rated the co-stars that she had had sex with on how good they were in the bedroom. So
wow. I don't want to get us in trouble here, but
yes.
when you look at the history of famous people and how they tragically go, when you look at like the breakup of the Beatles, everybody shoves that on Yoko Ono, and I'm sure in some sense or another that's true, but it's obviously a very complicated relationship with a bunch of people, and I'm sure there was more to it than that. But when you look at Tony's fall, I mean, as many people have noted, he had the greatest job in the history of the world. I mean, he literally just spent all day, 260 plus days a year, traveling the world, seeing exotic places, doing the things that so many of us long to do. He got to do that every day. Now, I saw him live. He used to do these live shows where he'd come through town and he'd, take the biggest theater in town and he would essentially just answer questions for hours. I saw him once by himself and once with Eric Repaire. And Eric was the one who found him when he was dead, which had to have, you know, Lord knows what that does to you. But when you look at the end of Tony's life, do you think that a lot of how that ended had to have been influenced by the way Ajay Argento treated him in those final months?
It's hard to look at it and conclude otherwise. There was another piece that I didn't include where Repaire, the night before he hanged himself, they had gone out, and I guess Tony was not in good spirits, and they were in hotel rooms next to one another. And he said that he listened through the wall and heard Bourdain snoring and how relieved he was to hear him still alive. And so those around him, it must have just been so visible that he was in such a bad place mentally. And you sometimes with suicides, Chris Cornell of Soundgarden comes to mind. The people seem to be kind of doing okay until they're just not. And, you know, they'll have their struggles, but it can often be shocking to people because it's, well, it seemed like everything was going well. And sometimes I think that's maybe attributed to it's going well because they've made a decision and they know what they're going to do. And so they're lucid.
They feel a little relieved.
But with Tony, it seems like it was just torture till the end when it just, he hit his breaking point and that was it.
You know, what's sad though, is that often when people are in this place, they need someone to be able to pull them out of it. Whether that's someone they work with, someone, you know, they love, you know, their dog, they just need someone to be able to pull them out of it. And obviously he was, you know, he was surrounded by people all the time. One of the other things he talks about this is that struggle of being famous, really worldwide famous, which is something neither you and I will ever understand. But he couldn't go anywhere without being accosted by people. But at the same time, he was very alone. And, you know, that's just such a sad thing to think about, because he was someone who brought so much joy to people when he would write or do his TV shows or do his speaking circuit. He was just someone who lit up a room. And at the same time, he seemed to be really, really struggling.
Exactly. It could be that the reason he was famous and the travel schedule and you know, just the way he operated could have made it difficult for those people to really be there for him. You know, he had people he was close to, you know, like Eric around, but he's traveling, he's constantly on the road. He wasn't in the same place as his roots. And so, you know, this is just speculation on my part, but that could have, you know, been a factor too. Is just, you're alone in a hotel room with a broken heart and you're struggling and that there's nobody, you know. I mean, yes, you've got a friend next door, but again, you're not in a place. You're just in a bad place, I guess, to be kind of metaphorical.
That's a good point. If you're not in familiar surroundings, you're not in comfortable surroundings, then a time like that can be, I guess, extra hard. And he was never in the same place for more than a few days, all year long. And that has to be something that I guess eventually wears on you.
I would guess. And again, as I mentioned, you know, not just, we don't know. There's a lot that goes on and when people decide to kill themselves, and it's a sad topic. And you know, anyone listening, if you're struggling, please reach out for help. And, but again, it really looks like his final relationship and the gusto with which he threw himself into it was not a positive factor in his life and not something that gave him joy at the end.
All right, let's move on to something a little less yes, depressing. Although sadly, a few weeks ago, the Queen died, but that motivated a lot of people to sort of take a closer look at the Queen. And Queen Elizabeth had a drink she preferred. It was called Dubonnet and Gin. It was a very specific recipe. Dubonnet is not the easiest thing in the world to find, as Rich will tell us here in a second. But Rich, this is a drink that is unique, right?
It is unique, and it doesn't have a name. It's just, you know, the Queen's Dubonnet and Gin, and it definitely the impact of the Queen's death became more obvious to me when I was searching out this Dubonnet, because I went to just liquor store after liquor store, and I would find the spot on the shelf where it was, should have been, and it was gone. And I'm guessing that it's one of those things that, you know, liquor stores buy, like, you know, once every 6 months or, you know, whatever. I'm not sure the product cycle there, but it's not something that I imagine you keep a lot of on stock. And, you know, I went, I had some liquor stores take my name and phone number. It's like, oh, we'll find it. We'll give you a call. I've still not gotten any of those calls. But last weekend, I was out running some errands, and there's a little liquor store that we had visited around Christmas on a way to a friend's house that live, where I live is basically a huge collection of small towns. And so they live in this different small town than us. And there was a out of the way liquor store. And I was like, and I was kind of in the area and I had some time, and it's like, what the hell? Let's go see if this place has it. And I get there and I'm looking around, and the guy asks, and he goes, oh, he's like, I know. He's like, I can see it. And he goes and checks his computer. He's like, I've got one in stock somewhere. And he scours the shelves. And I've given up because it wasn't where I would have thought it would be, because it's a aperitif. And it's a fortified wine. And he finally found it, the one bottle. And so I was able to make the Queen's drink, although I was not able to make it to her precise specifications, which I will tell you now. So what you do is you take two parts Dubonnet and one part gin. I used, she preferred, it wasn't Beefeater, but she obviously preferred
Gordon's London Dry was her preferred gin, apparently.
That's it. And I have, there's a distillery down the street from me, Fox Trail, and they have an Arkansas gin, which I've discussed before. And I don't drink enough gin to just keep a variety around. So that's what I had. So I did 2 ounces of the Dubonnet, 1 ounce of the gin. And what you do is you stir that, and then you place half of a lemon wheel on the top, and then sink it with two perfectly proportional ice cubes. Now, not being royalty, I do not have access to perfectly proportional ice cubes.
I don't know what that looks like. I mean, what is a perfectly proportionate ice cube? I'm not even sure what that means.
I'm not sure either. So I did deviate a little from the recipe there. And so I made it. I drank it. She would have it in the morning as kind of a pre-lunch, aperitif. And I can see why. It was very mild. It was not high on the alcohol content. Would I make this again? Probably not. I did not have the same love of it as the Queen did. I might try it one more time using her mother's recipe, which was equal parts Dubonnet and gin, just to see if the extra gin adds more heft. However, I have realized after finding this bottle, and of course I tasted it just on its own, it's pretty much sweet vermouth. So if anyone out there wants to just get an idea of the Queen's drink without having to seek out Dubonnet, you could use sweet vermouth and it would be pretty much the same. So having said that, and what will maybe a little foreshadowing here, I will probably make a Manhattan with the Dubonnet instead of sweet vermouth and see how that turns out.
I got to hand it to them. Their website address is doyoudubonnet.com.
Hey, that's good.
That's good. Like that's that's unique. I like that. It is interesting to me because I think you're right. I think it is essentially a fancy French version of sweet vermouth. But I'm intrigued to see how you use it, because after you go through all that damned effort to find a bottle of this, I think you got to find a million ways to use Dubonnet.
and I'm going to have to be creative here, because I actually searched out, I Googled cocktails I can make with Dubonnet, and there's just not a whole lot out there.
So that's what we might be doing the next few weeks, folks. We might be coming up with ways to use Dubonnet.
Fortunately, this was not like something I, gave an arm and a leg for. I mean, effort-wise, I gave a lot, but it was a $20 bottle, so it's not like I, sunk $50 into this or something, so I've got that going for me.
All right, well, I like that. Thanks again, Rich. Always a pleasure.
Hey, thank you, Brad.